for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. 40% of all the world's threatened bird species live in the Americas, and key to their survival and the future of all birds is the protection of habitats along their astonishing migration paths. Joining me as part of our Environmental Outlook series to discuss birds of the Americas and the threats they face, including the most immediate along the Gulf of Mexico, Margaret Atwood. She's both a conservationist, and an award-winning writer. Graham Gibson, he's an ornithologist and author of The Bedside Book of Birds. Greg Butcher, he's director of bird conservation at the National Audubon Society. And Rosa Maria Vidal, a Pro Natura, that's a nonprofit conservation organization in Mexico. We do invite all of you bird lovers to join us. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning and welcome to all of you.
Good morning.
Greg Butcher, start with the threat in the Americas that's most immediate right now, and that's the oil spill in the Gulf.
Right. Yeah, it's such a shame. This is, of course, springtime, and it's the time for birds to be arriving on their breeding grounds. They're courting. They're laying eggs. They're raising their young right now, and it should be a time of joy and happiness. And instead, we see this cloud of oil heading towards some of the richest areas along the Gulf of Mexico, and potentially even escaping the Gulf of Mexico, going up the East Coast of the United States, and just threatening an amazing abundance of birds found in some of the most important bird areas in the Americas.
How serious could this be in the long term?
Well, you know, oil and water doesn't mix, and birds and oil don't mix. And so the oil can very severely affect the food supply for the birds. And, of course, any of the oil that gets on the feathers of the birds really affects their survival.
And which birds would be under the most threat?
Well, right now, the oil's still in the water. And so the birds facing the most threat are those birds that dive into the water to catch fish for their food. And so we've got birds like the brown pelican. And we just celebrated taking the brown pelican off the endangered species list. And then this threat just goes right at the heart of a big population in the Gulf of Mexico.
So you've got the ocean-dwelling birds as well, though, don't you?
Right. So brown pelicans are nesting on these islands, as are a very big variety of terns. And terns are small to large black and white birds. They look a lot like gulls, but they're very much specialists on fish. And like the pelicans, they're diving into the Gulf of Mexico looking for a fish to bring up for their meal. And if they find oil instead, it's not a happy situation.
Greg Butcher is director of bird conservation at the National Audubon Society. Margaret Atwood, what a joy to see you again.
Lovely to see you.
You and your husband, Graham Green, have been avid bird conservationists for many, many years. How did that passion get started for you?
Well, it's different for each of us. And for me, it was really something I grew up with because my parents were naturalists and early conservationists back in the age when birders were thought of as being very strange, funny people, and everybody laughed at them and made up funny names about them. So they were early there. They were early Sierra Club, for instance. And I simply grew up with that awareness. And I went to BirdLife, this international organization that we're both members of and representing, because it is a working with people from the ground up organization. So it's not people versus birds, it's people and birds.
And for you, Graham Gibson, the health of birds in many ways is truly connected with the health of human beings.
No, absolutely. I mean, the cliche is the canary in the mine. Obviously, all creatures that are in trouble are warnings for us. I mean, we are not independent from them. We're all ourselves animals. We all depend upon the world for our lives. Birds are particularly important indicators because they're so popular. That for many reasons, people respond to birds very, very warmly. Partially, I think, because we associate them with creativity and the soul and imagination.
And do you see a particular bird that may have relevance to the life of human beings right now?
It depends where the human beings are. The birds that are central to a particular habitat, say what among BirdLife has all these important bird areas, people benefit for the protection of those of the birds in those areas, because if you have a large acreage which is being protected for the birds, then everything else living there is protected. So there's not one single bird, I don't think, but there may be a handful of them in every habitat that are particularly important.
Graham Gibson, he's an ornithologist, novelist, and the author of the Bedside Book of Birds. Margaret Atwood is conservationist and author of more than 40 books of fiction, poetry, and essays. Her best-selling novels include The Handmaid's Tale, Cat's Eye, and The Blind Assassin. Turning to you, Rosa Maria, the effort to protect birds must be an international effort. How much coordination do you see at this point?
Well, I think it's increasing. We share a lot of species from, like, you know, tropical migrants that goes to Mexico and to the south is more than 350 species. Almost 2 million of birds goes raptors goes through the river of raptors, that is a flyway in the east coast of Mexico, and those birds reach Argentina in the grasslands. So we share population, we share birds, and we share the joy of looking these birds through all the Americas. BirdLife, as Margaret was saying, is a partnership that acts. We have 20 partners in the Americas. Audubon is the partner of BirdLife here in the United States, and ProNatura is a partner in Mexico. We join efforts to work together for saving important bird areas and birds, but also we have more awareness of citizens, more awareness of private sector, and also from the governments. Next, in a few weeks, there is going to be this trilateral meeting of the governments of Mexico, Canada, and the United States that they meet to talk about migratory species, for example. So those are efforts that we all try to join in a way that cooperation really meets the important places and the people.
And when you talk about these migratory species, what are your efforts aimed at ensuring that somehow along the way these migratory paths will stay safe?
Exactly. We try to combine up many things, the needs of people in the ground, but also the needs of the birds. Like, for example, the coffee that you drink here. A lot of the coffee is produced in the highlands of Chiapas or Guatemala or Colombia. And this coffee is produced under the shade of the tropical forest. And this combination of products that has a use of the people, but also the forest that is behind it, brings habitat for the birds, but also economy and income for the local people. So we try to do this type of work. And if consumers here are more aware that buying this type of coffee or chocolate or other products that are growing in communities that considers the habitat for birds is a good thing for their birds, for our birds, I think that's a way that we all can share the efforts.
Rosa Maria Vidal of ProNatura, and that is a nonprofit conservation organization and bird life partner in Mexico. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can join us on Facebook or Twitter. How can you give me an overall sense of the bird population throughout the Americas? Do we have a number? Graham Gibson.
I don't.
Well, this book that is being launched tonight, in fact, with the important bird areas of the Americas in it, and it's been a huge effort with a lot of people contributing to it. If you get this book, which you can find on birdlife.org, that gives you a very good overview of what is migrating where and numbers and locations and habitats. It's right in this book, and it's being launched. Greg will tell us about the participation of the bank.
Mm-hmm. So we're being hosted by the Inter-American Development Bank, and I think they share our interests in promoting the welfare of birds and of people simultaneously. And so the sense is that these important bird areas are areas that are also important for people, and it's important to keep them natural because they're protecting watersheds that people use, they're protecting fish and game that people hunt and other products from the forest. And so the Inter-American Development Bank is going to help us protect these sites in the future and make sure that development happens in places that is much more
and
safe.
I have to say, this has got to be one of the heaviest and most extensive books. It's titled Important Bird Areas in the Americas. Stay with us. And here's our first email from Keith in Silver Spring. He says, I just wanted to share some good news about birds. I walked across the Key Bridge at 6:45 this morning, and I saw something I've never seen before. As I walked, four great blue herons flew over me in formation. Their slow, graceful wing stroke was beautiful. It is something that I think we humans at this point in our evolution, perhaps, are more and more concerned about. Do you agree, Margaret?
Oh, I absolutely do. And for instance, in the United Kingdom, there are 1 million members of the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, which is the UK's BirdLife partner. And in North America, far many more people are birders than are golfers, just for instance.
How fascinating. Golf
and tennis combined, isn't
indeed,
it?
Apparently, there are more people watching birds than playing golf and tennis combined.
I'm really interested in that. Had you heard that before, Greg?
I'm not that comparison, but it's really impressive, the number of people that watch birds. They say it's about 1 out of every 4 American adults. So I figure when I'm sitting on an airplane seat, I've got a 25% chance I can have a really good bird conversation with my neighbor.
I wonder if there is a sense of how many of the birds that we see in this country are actually migratory birds at this point?
Well, the numbers. There are millions of birds that are migratory, I mean, in terms of individuals, but it's around 350 species.
Species.
Yeah, that has to be more than the third of the species of the United States that go down. So many of the birds are shared, many, many of them.
So the air, the environment, the surroundings in each of those countries as these birds migrate has got to be healthy in and of itself, Graham.
What is the birds have been flying in migration forever, in our terms, at any rate, and they have many cases very established routes, and the expansion of human society is damaging many of those. Birds are coming in some cases from Argentina to the tundra, and that they feed, they must feed along the way, they must rest. And if they arrive somewhere and something has happened, then that puts extraordinary strain on them. Hummingbirds will fly across the Gulf of Mexico. Now, if when they arrive where they usually arrive and something terrible has happened, they're not in very good shape to adapt.
And that's precisely the subject of this email from Michael in Conway, Arkansas, who says, do you think that the relatively compact arrangement of Mexican cities is good for preserving nature habitats, including bird migration habitats, compared to sprawling U.S. cities? Rosa.
Well, the cities in Mexico are very, very compact and very dense, but we have still big areas of forest in the Yucatan Peninsula along the ridges of the mountains in the west and the east. So, and migratory species can adapt to different type of habitats in the south. It could be more specialized, the species here, but in the south they split and they can use a larger number of habitats. And it depends very much on the species. I think that facing development is difficult. And the how to combine development and conservation is probably the key question that we all have. That's why this presentation of this book in the Inter-American Bank is very important, because it's a message to a lot of people saying we have to develop, yes, but we have to care about the birds, and the birds as an indicator of biodiversity.
And the book that Rosa Maria Vidal is talking about is titled Important Bird Areas, America's Priority Sites for Biodiversity Conservation. And here's an email from Dorothy in Winston-Salem. She says, the Platte River stretching across Nebraska has always been known as a mile wide and an inch deep. Doesn't a major flyway rely on this river? What birds besides cranes are part of this flyway? I wonder if you can answer that, Greg.
Well, one of my favorite birdwatching experiences of all time was I went out to the Platte River in late March. And when I got there, it was all ice and snow, and there weren't any birds at all. And I just was devastated. I thought, you know, maybe we'd come too soon. But 3 or 4 days later, the ice dam broke, and the river came open, and there were hundreds of thousands of sandhill cranes, and there were geese and ducks flying everywhere. So there's, you know, 20 different species of ducks that use that river, and they are just as abundant as the cranes are. And then there's raptors. So there's red-tailed hawks, and there's kestrels, and there's all these hawks that are also filling the skies. And it just is totally alive with energy in early spring, and really a truly bird-rich area and one of the most important bird areas we have in our country.
Now, Margaret, you and Graham live in Canada, so what birds are you particularly concerned about and watching?
Well, like all of us, we're concerned about the woodland warblers, the ones that have the most beautiful songs in spring and that migrate up through the United States from Central and South America, and they go into the boreal forest of Canada where they breed. So a number of things can affect them along the way, over which we Canadians don't have any control. So coffee growing, as Rosa said, shade-grown organic coffee. The Smithsonian Institute has a bird-friendly coffee seal, but if you just look for the shade-grown, you're already doing something good. Keeping your cat in during migrations, spring and fall. One of the big hazards is tall office buildings with shiny windows that keep their lights on at night. A lot of these migrating birds fly into that labyrinth of light, get confused, and just fall down exhausted. Mm. And there is a Green Building Council in the United States, and there is information about how to make that glass non-attracting to birds, in fact, repelling to birds. And think of the energy we would save, for instance, if we turned the lights of those office buildings off at night.
But in this considering the potential hazards that are out there for all these birds, it's truly miraculous that they make it year after year.
That some of them do. Yeah, it is miraculous. And there are people who monitor the sound of them flying over. They now can hear them, and it's like a river going over. This river of birds goes over at night, which is largely when they migrate, and it is astounding.
Now, here's an email from Brian. Is there any way to insert floating devices armed with some sort of audio frequency emitters to drive birds away from the area, or is this an impractical idea? What do you think,
Greg? There's all kinds of bird-scaring devices. It turns out there's a lot of human creations where we want to keep birds away, and it turns out that you have to be both loud and active to keep birds away. So, say at airport runways where it's important to keep birds away, usually people employ peregrine falcons to fly at the birds to scare them away, or they take dogs out on the runways to scare them away. And just noise by itself usually isn't enough. So you usually need something physical to really chase them out of an area. So you might use something like a kite or something like that that would fly over a space and make it look unsafe for a bird to land.
Graham Gibson, the climate has been something that certainly people around the world are concerned about. To what extent are climate changes affecting bird migration patterns?
Well, that's complex, almost in every way you can think of, actually. We Margaret and I, were in the high Arctic 2 years ago, and we got far enough up to see one of the very rare gulls, which is the ivory gull. And it's a small gull that's a bird of pack ice. And what they feed on is what the polar bear leaves behind of a seal. The pack ice is melting. If and when the pack ice goes, there will be no ice for the seals to crawl up onto for the polar bears to catch, and therefore that the food of the ivory gull will vanish.
There must be a great many other birds about whom you are concerned, Greg Butcher, who may be suffering because of climate change.
Yeah, we're also very concerned about sea level rise. And so many of our coastal species, like the piping plover that's on our coastal beaches.
The piping plover.
Yeah, tiny little bird.
How large?
Smaller than a robin.
Okay.
Sparrow size, perhaps. And it just runs along on the edge of the water on the beach and
very
actually
beautiful.
puts its nest into the beach, and it's kind of ghost colored so that it disappears against the sand. But every piping plover in the wintertime is found on this sand, and if the sea level rises to cover up the beaches we have now, and we put barriers to protect our houses so there's less and less natural habitat, we're going to lose birds like the piping plover.
Rosa Maria.
Yeah, we also look in those changes in the south, like in the tropical areas where the fruits are coming late and the reproduction, the breeding season is coming late. And also the birds that come back to the United States are still there. I mean, it's like everything is like changing in
terms
of
the timing. Turned around somehow, yeah.
So we don't know exactly what are going to be the consequences of those changes. And it's more like the birds and the nature is adapting more quickly than we are. They're really reacting to the changes in the climate right now.
When you say they're adapting more quickly than we are, what do you mean?
Yeah, because they are changing all these patterns of the behavior. I mean, as I said, the fruits, I mean, in the tropical areas are now taking longer to be...
to ripen.
Exactly. So to be available for the birds. And then the breeding is changing. Everything is connected. And the birds that go down are taking longer to come back here to the United States. So they feel this I mean, it's amazing. All nature is moving. And the human beings are still thinking and what we are going to do. So that's...
While the birds are acting. Go ahead, Greg.
So one of the concerns we have is that for birds to be successful in reproduction, they have to have their young appear when a good food supply appears to support those young. So the biggest concern we have is that things will get out of sync and that the birds will produce their young and the food won't be there to support them. We already had that problem in California for a bird called the Cassin's auklet that breeds off the coast of California, and it depends on cold water upwellings of seawater to produce the food that they feed their young. And the young were in the nest and ready to be fed, and the cold water upwellings didn't appear. Mm-hmm. And so twice in the last 10 years, there's complete reproductive failure of Cassin's auklets off the coast of California.
Mm-hmm. Greg Butcher, he's director of bird conservation at the National Audubon Society, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We have many callers waiting, so let's open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Boston, Massachusetts. Good morning, Susan. You're on the air.
I'd like to ask your experts to speak to the decimation of species of birds from bird feeders. Thank you.
I'm sorry, I did not quite get that. Did you get that, Greg?
Yeah, there's some concern about bird feeders, but I think decimation is not a word I would use. Bird feeding supports birds like chickadees and titmice and wonderful birds and brings them into people's backyards, and I think people get a tremendous amount of pleasure.
But what's from feeding the problem? The
birds. There can be some problems if we're feeding birds like grackles and starlings and other birds that are predators on bird populations. So I think the most important thing is not to stop feeding, but to feed specialized foods that are attracting the birds that we really want to see, like cardinals.
It also be that, as you set up a bird feeder, you're... the cats, the predators to the birds begin to understand what's going on there.
Yeah, you certainly, if you have a lot of outdoor cats in your neighborhood, it's probably not a good idea to be feeding. And in such a case, you might be able to use a hanging bird feeder that just brings in the upper-level birds and
right.
Be feeding on the ground.
Let's go to New Market, Maryland. Good morning, Elaine.
Yes, I was just reading in the Sun Herald about a representative Gene Taylor commenting on what's happening down there in his neck of the woods, Mississippi. He is downplaying all of this. He's saying that he doesn't plan that any of the oil sheen that comes into the marshes should evaporate naturally, and that he probably won't do anything but leave it alone and let nature take its course.
Might nature take its course here?
Nature will take its course, but nature will take years and years and years to take its
course.
So
it's going to need some assistance.
Absolutely.
What kind of assistance?
Well, the most critical thing is to get the oil out of the environment as soon as we can. And the booms that they're setting up to try to prevent it from getting into the marshes are, of course, very, very important, because prevention is much easier than the solution afterwards. But we have learned a lot about getting oil out of natural environments, and unfortunately it's dirty work, it takes a lot of time, but I do think we can speed up nature's natural processes.
Margaret.
Well, what can I say? Sure, nature will take its course. How many hundreds of years have you got? And while nature is taking its course, you have a decimated shoreline and birds that are going without food. And I have to say, it's going to wreck the shrimp industry, too.
Yes. We've already heard from the fishermen whose livelihoods may be affected for years and years, but those birds may suffer more immediately, would you think, Graham?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, observations like that, if it was an individual, you could just ignore it. But if you're a politician, even if he's not in your own country, one tends to despair.
Graham Gibson, he's an ornithologist, a novelist, and author of The Bedside Book of Birds. Short break, and we'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant at Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And by the Aetna Foundation, committed to improving health, wellness, and access to high-quality, affordable care for everyone. Learn more at aetnafoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the SEC, Justice Department, and Senate investigations into Goldman Sachs and consider the role Goldman played in the financial crisis. We talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Gretchen Morgenson, a financial reporter and columnist for The New York Times. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. One of the books I have in front of me is really quite an important volume titled Americas, and it features priority sites for biodiversity conservation. It is really quite an accomplishment. And Rosa Maria, I'm wondering how this entire book was brought together, how many people contributed to it, the kinds of information that's in it is just extraordinary.
Yeah, I think this is one of the best accomplishments that we have as partnership in BirdLife. Having this book is really a guidance for our work and for many other people from the governments, for politicians, for citizens, academy, everybody. And more than 150 authors are involved in this process. In each country, we work first the identification of the IBAs, the important bird areas. And that is based on basic thresholds, that is The endemic species, the birds that are only found in those sites, the species that are more threat, that are more endangered in the countries, the areas that has more abundance, I mean, the areas that are more important for species that go together, and also the areas that are kind of a funnel that is a part of the flyway. So we identify those areas in the Americas, first in each country, and then we pull all that information together to share it at the level of the continent. And it's an ongoing process. We found more than 2,000 IVAs in the Americas, and almost 2,000 birds are represented in these IVAs that achieve this criteria. Almost a third of these areas are protected by different means in the countries, but we still have more than 40% that doesn't have any protection. So this is a way that we can direct our effort. And also we have identified the important bird areas for migratory species along the continent. So also that helps countries and governments to work together to protect these sites.
Now, explain to us, Greg Butcher, how the Audubon Society has been involved in this project.
Right. So the Audubon Society is the U.S. partner for BirdLife International. And so we are doing within our country what they're doing in hundreds of countries around the globe. And that's identifying the most important sites. We've done it a little bit differently by doing it state by state. So we actually have 3,000 important bird areas, and we have important bird areas in every state in the country. And then we check to see which of those are globally important as well. And about 500 of those so far we've figured are globally important. But we have volunteers, you know, really thousands of people have contributed to identifying these sites, providing us information on the sites. And we have hundreds of people now working at these sites to make these better places for birds.
And what is it that creates an important bird site?
Well, there's actually several things. And the first thing you're looking for, of course, is all the endangered species. So in Colorado, there's a bird called the Gunnison sage grouse. And the Gunnison Basin is the most important place for Gunnison sage grouse. So that's one of the real important bird areas of our country. The other thing that makes an important bird area is just sheer numbers of birds. So we're talking about the Platte River in Nebraska. Well, what an important bird area is that? I mean, there's so many hundreds of thousands of birds there. And then there's other special species that are only found in the eastern forests or only found in the deserts of the Southwest. And we try to make sure there's important bird areas for those species as well.
All right, let's go back to the phones to Ernie in Charlotte, North Carolina. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
With the springtime, a lot of people getting out in their yards and adding plants. Could you address to the average person who might own a third of an acre the importance of choosing natives over non-natives and why this is important not only to migratory but the local wildlife there?
Margaret.
All right. Well, the native plants are much more likely to provide the kinds of foods that native birds eat. So if you're planting native, look for plants that produce things that your native birds will eat. The other thing is native plants are much more likely to be drought tolerant and not to need pesticides, which we've done away with for cosmetic purposes in Ontario anyway. And those are three good reasons right there. And by the way, you don't need a huge, humongous, great big green lawn. In fact, you can replace your imported type of green lawn with some very nice native plants that provide a lovely ground cover and don't need all of the stuff that people dump onto their lawns.
Graham Gibson.
I think basically what the advantage of native plants is those are the ones that made the birds. Those are the ones the birds have always used. So that when if you put in strangers, they don't recognize them. What migratory birds need is something that is there for them that they have known collectively for a very long time.
Give me a specific example if you can.
Well, I mean, it's if one thinks of monarch butterflies going away from birds, what's the plant?
Milkweed.
The milkweed is critical for that. And I think you can go through certain kinds of warblers live in certain kinds of trees.
And that milkweed is so gorgeous.
Yes, it is.
In and of itself. Yes. I used to have it in my own garden.
And it smells wonderful.
And it smells wonderful. Let's go to Avon, New York. Good morning, David. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. I know this is going to be of a massive magnitude, but my idea is, first of all, I want to ask who and why they put the fire out in the first place on that rig. And two, they have these booms that are holding the oil, but I believe they should have something that would put, like sponges, anything that would solidify this oil in the sense that at least the birds and the fish cannot go through it in order to be enveloped by this oil.
Rosa Maria, do you want to comment? No. you want to comment, Greg?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of frustration on the part of a lot of people that we don't have better technology to get the oil out of the water and to get the oil out of the environment. And if there's one thing we do on this, we need to remember that it is going to happen again, and we're going to work like the devil to try to keep it from happening again, but it will happen again, and we need to improve our technology for preventing spills like this and for cleaning up after they happen.
It really is such a problem, Margaret.
I think they are hoovering up some of it. They're sort of sucking it up, and then they will put it through some kind of a spinner to separate the oil from the water. So they are, I think, doing that according to the newspaper, which, of course, I always believe. they're doing some of that right now.
All right, let's go to Arlington, Virginia. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And Ms. Atwood, I just wanted to say how much your novels have meant to me and many of my generation. My question has to do with climate change and fresh water along the key flyways in the Americas. I know that climate change is supposed to greatly reduce the availability of fresh water, for example, in California, and I just wanted to hear your expert's comment. Thank you.
Greg.
Yeah, I think that's one of the greatest concerns we have about climate change is all the places will end up being drier. And the interesting thing is some places will get the same amount of rain as they got before, but they'll end up being drier because of more evaporation because of the warmer temperatures. And in the Southwest, we're projecting less rain, and so hotter weather, less rain, we expect to be a real water shortage. And the problem is, of course, people have great needs for water, too. And so in many cases, there's more demand for water than there is water available. And it's going to be a huge issue that we're facing.
So how is that likely to affect bird migration?
Well, basically, the drier it is, the fewer birds there are. And so the volume of migration will probably drop in places that get drier.
Are we seeing that already?
We are. Anytime there's a drought, you see drops in bird populations. We're tremendously concerned about a place called the prairie potholes out in the Dakotas, in eastern Montana, in western Minnesota. They call it the duck factory for the United States. And those ducks spend the winter all through the United States from California to North Carolina, and though that production factory will decrease in its ability to produce ducks and other wetlands birds and other wetland species if those areas get drier, as is predicted.
Here's an email from Diane. She's in Indianapolis. She says, I'm curious about the relationship between migratory birds and wind energy. Wind energy seems to be so promising as an alternative, non-fossil fuel-based source of energy, but I'm concerned about its potential disruption to birds and their flight patterns. How serious is this threat, and can anything be done about it? Rosa Maria.
Well, that's that concern we also share, because we are also worried about this, the wind farms in the flyways. One of the value of having this big book that you have in front is that we're trying to put in the map where are those sites that we should avoid for establishing this type of structures.
And are those engineers who are constructing these wind energy sources abiding by
this? That's part of the idea, is that we can share with all these other sectors. You're not talking about these problems only with environmentalists, but all, I mean, but the people that is taking decisions on this new green energy that we say, well, yes, it's going. We need green energy, but also we need to have energy
smart that green energy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So those are our concerns too, and there is a. I think that having this information and also trying to plan with carefully, I think that there is a lot of examples in Spain, here in the United States, and in different parts of the world where you can really mix wind farms and wind energy with the birds, but you have to be very careful where and how to establish that.
Graham Gibson.
I think that all major bird organizations, BirdLife and Audubon and the Royal Society for Protection of Birds, they all, the basic thing about wind is you keep out of places where birds gather in very large numbers. It's not clear how damaging they are, but that doesn't mean that we know how dangerous it is. Certainly wind farms are hugely destructive to bats. Migrating bats or even bats along a shore, because they have lights on at night, insects are attracted, the bats gather, and that wind farms are deadly to them. And it's not that they hit them. What happens when these great paddles go by, there's a catastrophic drop in air pressure. And that's what's damaging the bats, apparently.
Graham Gibson, he's an ornithologist, a novelist, and the author of The Bedside Book of Birds, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show, and to Toledo, Ohio. Good morning, John.
Yes. I have traveled northwest Ohio and lower Michigan in my work for the last 25 or 30 years, and every morning when I go to the gas station, one of the main things that I had to do was try to get all the bugs cleaned off my windshield. I realized, actually, sometime last year, that I don't do this anymore, and that around various street lights and so on, there's not all the bugs that used to be, the insects. This, to me, must have some effect on birds and so on, and I just wonder if they have any comments or they have noticed this also.
Margaret Atwood.
Yes, this is a very good thing to bring up, because it has to do with the widespread agribiz use of pesticides. And if you read Bill McKibben's new book called Earth with Two A's, I don't know how you pronounce that, but chapter 4, one of the things he says is one of the things we really need to do to mitigate against the effects of climate change, such as droughts and floods, is to go back to small-scale mixed organic farming. Build up the soils, because living soil is in itself an absorber of carbon dioxide. And also by doing that kind of farming or not using pesticides, you are increasing the biodiversity, not only for birds, but for really everything. And in my opinion, the government should subsidize small-scale mixed organic farming, because they should give them a carbon credit, because they're absorbing carbon by making the soil alive again. Agribiz uses dead soil.
Graham Gibson.
It's a very good observation, because it's the aerial feeding birds, the swallows and the nighthawks and so forth, that class of birds that is, I think, suffering particularly in loss. And I don't suppose many people know what's happening to the insects in the air, but if they're not on your car, they're not around.
And finally, from Silver Spring, Maryland, Sandra says, I've been looking at birds since I was a child, noticed a tremendous reduction in the number over the past 50 years as we've cut down our trees and buried our fields in asphalt. Spring used to arrive full of the song and color of warblers, thrushes, and tanagers. Now when I go out searching and listening, the forest is almost quiet. Bruce, Greg Butcher, is that true?
Things are definitely a lot quieter than they were when I was younger. There's no question about it. We do have seen a decrease in migratory birds. The number of birds that are flying through is a lot less than it used to be. And certainly humans have had a very large impact on the environment, and we need to look for ways where we can continue our quality of life and lower our impact on the environment if we want to share it with these beautiful creatures.
I hope we can do that, and I'm sure we can with the help of Bird Life International and this extraordinary book. It's titled Important Bird Areas of the Americas, Priority Sites for Biodiversity Conservation. You've heard the voices of Margaret Atwood, Graham Gibson, Greg Butcher, Rosa Maria Vidal. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.